The News Dissector with Danny Schechter. Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here. Catherine Waters in the studio with me. We're going to be doing the News Dissector Radio Hour based on the work on my blog, newsdissector.net, newsdissector.net, which I write every day, offering a kind of critical look at the news and dissections of various issues. Today I focus on the death of Andrew Breitbart, the right-wing provocateur and analyst who, you know, has done a lot to try to undo progressive movements with video exposés, if you want to call them that, of Acorn and various other provocative activities. So we're going to be talking about that a little bit later. We're also going to be hearing from an anarchist activist in the Occupy movement, talk a little bit about the issues of anarchism, which have been raised and debated maybe for over 100 years, but are being debated again with great intensity within the Occupy movement. In a second, we'll be going to meet former Marine Sergeant Shamar Thomas, who came to public attention, a dramatic incident in Times Square when the police were facing off with occupiers, and he spoke up and stood out as an challenging police conduct, and his credentials as an Iraq veteran really shut the NYPD down, at least in that particular moment. He questioned them. He challenged them. We'll be hearing more about that in a minute. He's joining us on the phone. But first, Shamar, I don't know if you can hear me, but here's a little song that's been done by Polarity One on Occupy.
That are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game. Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
Well, this is a movement moment right here on the radio. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here. There's a phone number you can call to join us at 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. It's a free call here on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. So that's what you're listening to, and that's what we're talking about today. So, Sergeant, I guess, or Shamar Thomas, are you with us?
Yes, I am. How you doing, Danny?
Thank you so much. You know, we're friends with David DeGraw, who I think you know.
Yes.
And people were very impressed by an event that you basically helped shape in Times Square by standing up to the NYPD. Just as by way of introduction, because I want to talk to you more about your experience in the military and your impressions of Occupy, but set the scene for us. What happened on that day?
Okay, well, it started out, I went to Occupy Wall Street for the first time on October 5th, and that's where I actually met David DeGraw. It was the first day I went. And basically, when I got out there and I actually saw the police brutality firsthand, it was shocking to me because it wasn't, you know, it was in real life, and the people were actually being just pulled out of the crowd randomly. And the random selection of the beatings kind of, like, it startled me a little bit. And so I actually walked away from Occupy Wall Street with my head down the first day. When I came back on the 15th, well, that was the third time, but when I came on the 15th to Times Square, I saw people getting brutalized again. And like, if you watch the beginning of the video, you see me, like, walking on a side street. And what happened was, when they saw me trying to get to the people who were actually being hurt, they put up nets, and that's why I was arguing with them initially, And, you know, that's all I really could do was, you know, voice my opinion and speak out, because they wouldn't even let me get there. That's why, you know, that's where the 30 cops come from.
So that was quite a dramatic moment. We actually have the video here. We'd like to play a little of it just to remind our audience and also introduce it to people who don't know about this incident, because, you know, it was a very powerful example of, here we have the police who are, you know, patriotically correct, you know, hands over their hearts, star-spangled banner, et cetera and so forth, engaging in brutally suppressing freedom of speech in Times Square, the center of New York. I mean, how bizarre is that? And here we have you, an Iraq veteran, observing all of this and deciding not to just sit down and walk away, but actually to confront them. Let's hear what we can get out of this video, and then let's talk some more.
See it, baby. They don't lie.
Let's go.
They don't lie. They don't lie. They don't lie, tough guy. This is not a war zone. This is not a war zone. These are unarmed people. It doesn't make you tough to hurt these people. It doesn't make you tough to hurt these people. It doesn't. I don't care. I don't care about these people. I put in my work. It doesn't lie. It does not make you tough to hurt these people. There's nothing tough about it. Nothing. If you want to go fight, go to Iraq and Afghanistan. But you want to be here hurting U.S. citizens. If you want to go kill and hurt people, go to Iraq. Why are you hurting U.S. citizens? Why? What difference does it make? Did you get honor out of this? Did you get honor out of hitting people with batons? Is that what you get? Why are you doing this?
Let's not stop here. We got to walk down the block.
It just is unbelievable that y'all are doing this to people. That y'all are doing this to people. Why are y'all gearing up like this is war?
Guys,
this is not war.
Let's go, folks. We can
this is not war. Why are y'all acting like this? No one has guns.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Shamar Thomas, what a moment that was. And that would take a lot of guts on your part to stand up and raise that question. I'm sure you were as emotional as the moment was. And in listening to it now, you know, we realize the passions that were unleashed in these moments as the police, acting under orders, coming down from Rafe, you know, from the police commissioner and from, you know, the mayor, basically set out to crack down on Occupy Wall Street, which was a movement challenging the financial institutions that the mayor has been a part of. He is a bankster. He is part of that whole world. And now along comes you, a lone sergeant, you know, an activist, you know, in a sense, comes into this particular you know, moment and stands up, you know, so bravely. What was the reaction of the people there to your involvement?
Okay, let me start off by saying this first, just because, you know, this is the biggest question that I get from everybody. Just clarifying my statements about war. I'm against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and, you know, what people don't understand is that it wasn't something that I thought was going to be viral on the internet or that I even knew that would be this big. But in saying that, what I mean is, like, the wars that are going on in Iraq and Afghanistan are a fact. That's what's going on. And we have so many 18, 19-year-old troops that need leadership. And so it's like, if you want to be physical and want to actually be, you know, test your mettle in combat, we have a place for you to go. You know, whether it's right or wrong, you know, whether you believe in it or not, that's the place where you need to go. When I was a kid, everybody said, hey, if you want to be a tough guy, join the Marines, you know, so that's why I meant I don't believe in war. I don't believe in sending anybody to war. But you know, like I said, there's a you know.
But this was, but this seems to be an example of war right here in the streets of New York. I mean, you walk into a conflict, you walk into a combat zone in the, you know, in the Great White Way, as they call it, you know, the entertainment zone of New York in Times Square.
Yeah, crazy.
And you responded. I don't think you responded to promote yourself. You were really trying to challenge these police. What was their reaction? I mean, these are people who are flag wavers, a lot of them, you know?
Well, you know, the reaction, when I walked down the street, I got a lot of, you know, hugs and handshakes. But, you know, the actual police that were there, they were just, you know, I think it was like a little bit of embarrassment because they understood what I was saying. And they knew that they really, you know, they really didn't have any, you know, a comeback for it because, you know, I have family members that are in the police department that are like, I don't know why these guys are not getting overtime and leaving these people alone. We had, you know, the Giants had a parade where they had a million fans out there drinking beer, you know, at 11 o'clock in the morning and nobody was beat. So it's just, you know, somebody, you know, has to do something at some point. And, you know, we call ourselves warriors in the Marine Corps and a lot of parts of the military. And I don't understand how people can sit back on their couch and watch people being abused and not do anything. So
you're listening. Let me just tell folks again, you're listening to Shamar Thomas, who came to public attention. I don't think sought the moment visibly, but when the moment occurred and, you know, he didn't shirk from it, he stood up to the police in a very emotional encounter that really galvanized the entire city when they saw it, you know, on the air or saw it on YouTube. Sergeant Thomas was recently on PRN's show Occupy the Hood, which you can hear Thursday at 7 here on PRN FM. So, you know, in fact, you know, we're covering this Occupy movement like a glove, you know. But
yeah,
you can join us on the phone, folks, at 888-874-4888 if you want to ask him a question, if you want to share your own view about what happened. Catherine, you've been an active occupier. What was your response to this?
Hi, Shamar.
Thanks
for being on. I watched the video like a few times, you know, and it was like I watched, you know, the cops and they just pretty much stood there just totally unresponsive as you know, it's almost like when my computer just freezes up. Like it's overwhelmed and it just doesn't know what to do. Like they know, like you were literally, you know, shaking them out of their programming and they knew that, you know, you were right. But, you know, in order to do their job and keep their pensions and all, they kind of, you know, are just like following those orders. And then you could see the white shirt kind of coming in and sort of like, you know, doing their usual, you know, keeping people moving on the sidewalk kind of thing, you know. And, so, I mean, yes, I mean, you definitely shook them up and, you know, hopefully made some of them think and question what they do.
Shamar, could you...
Oh, I've gotten letters.
From NYPD?
They contacted me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about you? Because, you know, people didn't know your background and history. How long were you in the Marines? Where were you... You were involved in Iraq. What was your job there? What did you do? How did you feel about it?
Okay. Well, basically, I'm an Army brat. My mother did 20 years in the military. My stepfather did 24 years. So I'm from New York. I used to go back and forth from, you know, Roosevelt, New York, to Germany, then from Brooklyn to Washington, like, you know. And when I was 17 years old, I joined the Marine Corps. My mother, being in the Army 20 years, told me that less than a year of you being joining the Marines, you'll be in Iraq. Didn't believe her. Less than 1 year of me joining the Marines, I was in Iraq in 2004. I took part in the Second Battle of Fallujah in November of 2004. And then my mother was in Iraq at the same time with me, and she had been in 18 years at this time. And I went to Iraq the second time where I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of a detention facility that went incident-free the whole time. We didn't have any cases of abuse or anything like that. I got out the Marine Corps in 2007, and I've been going to college, and that's it. And I do community activism. I've been going to high schools and juvenile detention facilities, and I do community organizing because I know that we can't get rid of the gang, so I started an initiative to stop kids from joining gangs, where I asked gang leaders to not recruit kids that are 18 years old to join the gang so that, you know, there'll be a generation gap. So, since I can't stop gang banging, so that's pretty much what I do in my community.
Well, you know, that's so important, Shamar, and it's something that we need to find ways to build bridges between people who are working in your community, people who are struggling with the problems of poverty and a poor educational system and, you know, and violence, and the people who are trying to transform Wall Street and see economic power as so unjustly concentrated in the 1%, where the 99% in this country are struggling to survive. Priya Reddy is in the studio. She was there that day in Times Square and observed the police brutality. You've heard of Sergeant Thomas. What's your take on it, Priya?
Well, I'm definitely one of those 99% that you speak about struggling in poverty as an independent journalist. I saw some police brutality that day, but more so throughout the Occupy movement, and I was also there during the raid of Zuccotti Park and saw quite a bit of police misconduct and ruthlessness displayed. So this has been an overall pattern of response towards the Occupy movement from the 1% or the police or however you choose to look at our opposition.
You know, it's funny, Shamar, because there seems to be a link between your own experience in the military and what we're now seeing as the militarization of the police, more weapons being given to police forces, more, you know, like sound machines and this sort of thing. And I just read that the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has now authorized the use of drones in the United States. Okay, so we have enhanced surveillance. There's a case out in Ohio, Indiana, I forget where a judge ruled that you don't need a warrant to tap into people's cell phones. In this case, it was a drug bust. But, you know, it's very easy once you criminalize one practice to try to criminalize another, and they seem to be criminalizing dissent. So we have this whole repressive effort, you know, in a sense, you know, who's occupying Zuccotti Park now but the police and the real estate company? In other words, the occupation was an effort at liberation and transformation. It wasn't to kind of have a park to camp in, you know.
But wasn't that the problem, Danny, that in fact Wall Street was doing the occupying of our, you know, in a big way of our nation, and so we had to reoccupy our own lives and our country?
You know, Shamar, how do you see the Occupy movement is certainly reaching out. There is Occupy the Hood. There is Occupy the Barrio. There are efforts to, I've seen the movement, you know, become a lot more multicultural, multiracial. There seems to be more sensitivity on that issue, more efforts to stop foreclosures, for example, in East New York and other communities of color. How do you feel about Occupy? What should they be doing? What should the movement be doing that they aren't, do you think? Or how can we have a bigger impact?
Okay. That's a great question. Glad I get to answer this. But basically, my whole feeling on Occupy is that it's an outstanding movement. It's, you know, it's the social movement of our time. It's the civil rights movement of our time. But, you know, I think with a lot of the issues that are going on, it raises so much awareness, but people don't know what to do after that. And so Occupy is raising awareness on foreclosures, but it's not telling, you know, people how to deal with it on a regular basis or how somebody can implement it in their own neighborhoods. And that's the issue that I have. And another issue that I have is that I feel like Occupy, you know, we have so many people who are, you know, I've met so many intelligent people, and it's like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg made Facebook in his dorm room, and so it's like, out of all the people in Occupy Wall Street, we can't find a way to create jobs within our own, you know what I mean? Create a $1 billion business where we can actually take care of the people, because all the things like corporate personhood and, you know, Citizens United, all of these, you know, government issues, you know, all of these politics, you know, that's what I call it. But all of this politics is going to take a while, because you have so many people who know this game and that are in position to, you know, stop it. And so I feel like we have to start, you know, learning how to take care of, you know, our own. But there are, don't get me wrong, there are occupiers like Occupy Western New York, where, you know, they have a farmland where they're trying to, raise different cattle and all natural and everything like that. And so I feel like we need to, bring our heads together to, solve our own problems, so to speak, and continue raising awareness, because the awareness, there's so much stuff that, like hydro fracking, I didn't even know about that before Occupy Wall Street. So it's like there's so many issues that are, getting put to the forefront, but it's like, what do our people do once they get these issues? We know what's going on. We know the government is not doing it. So what can we do next? And that's where I feel like that's the only thing that Occupy Wall Street has to work on is giving people the tools to actually carry on the mission.
You know, Shamar, this is a part of the tension that we were going to talk about a little bit later with Priya Reddy, who's in the studio with us. You know, on the one hand, the desire to create the kind of society that we want to live in right now, to try to find ways to improve relationships between people, be honest with each other, have some sort of democratic culture so people can have a say in what's going on, not just looking up at leaders, but also have a process that people can take part in. In many ways, Zuccotti Park was not just a campground. It was an experiment, really, in people actually taking care of each other and themselves through the kitchen, through sanitation, the people's library, all the different aspects of it had a community service dimension to it, but also a resistance dimension. In other words, it's like you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You can try to have a decent society and also fight against the power, stand up against the people on top. And that's, I think, partly what I hear you saying. It's like, just protest in itself is not sufficient. But on the other hand, we need to find ways of helping each other because, just this week there was a march across the Brooklyn Bridge by students in debt. There are students who are dropping out of school, can't afford to pay these ridiculous loans back that they were, in a sense, saddled with. And you have a tremendous oppression going on of young people in America, of people of color, of one out of two black men in New York were reported out of work. I mean, this is a catastrophe. It's a depression. It's not a recession. What I'm trying to get at is we have to educate, agitate, activate. I don't know. I'm running out of eights, but,
Maybe we could start an Occupy school.
Well,
I think someone is.
An Occupy College.
Yeah. Well, I think we need to do stuff like that. But, Shamar, we also need your voice in all of this. I don't think you're aware, maybe adequately, maybe you are, and you seem like a humble person and you're not on an ego trip. But this movement needs leadership. That doesn't mean it needs leaders running things, on top of the people. But we do need people from different communities to participate in this, to stand up, to help guide people. A lot of people in Occupy are against the war. And, since you're in the Marines, they might be perceived, somehow you're part of the war. You're a war criminal or what have you, without really hearing what you think. There are so many.
Well, I walk around with a sign that says end all war, so I'm usually good.
I just had one thing. Shamar, I just wanted to get your take on the NDAA and what your thoughts on that were.
Okay, I mean, what I see about the NDAA is that, I've gotten so much information and background stuff, and, I understand that, many parts of it have already been, established for years. But what I feel about the NDAA and the wording of it is where, they're trying to, I feel like they're trying to stop activism. And, oppression is the number one, resource of consumerism, so... it's like that's the NDAA is our oppression. So it's like, they're forcing us to, not forcing us, but it's just kind of weird to me that the president signed this on December 31st on New Year's Eve. It's just certain things that happen within our structure that it's like, you can't, just keep letting it go, past your ear and, one ear and out the other. So, The National Defense Authorization Act is, you know, the act to oppress activism. That's how I feel about it.
You know, we have to also really be very clear that because somebody's in the military, because somebody's been assigned and does a job in Iraq, they support the policies. That doesn't follow necessarily.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of resistance in the military, a lot of concern by people there. They're the people who have suffered the most with these nonstop, what is that, you know, where they keep getting resent, you know, destroying their families, redeployed or destroying their families. When they come back, there's no jobs for them. I mean, you know, many are in hospitals with brain damage and other issues. I mean, this is a catastrophe, disaster.
They say that there's more soldiers that commit suicide from post-traumatic stress than actually die in the war.
So I guess the bottom line here, we're so happy that you could join us on this program today and add your voice. We'd love to have you on anytime. We'd like you to, give us some feedback on things you're doing, because we want people to follow you. Is there you're on Facebook, I understand.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, SGT, period, Shamar Thomas. I have SGT, Shamar Thomas, USMC. One Marine vs. 30 Cops, they have information there where you can find me when you go into the YouTube. But I'm going to be at Wall Street in the next few weeks, and I'll be letting people know what I'm going to do. I actually have to go out of New York State this week. There's some big stuff happening that I can't talk about yet. So just be excited. Thanks to all the Wounded Warriors. Thanks for all the service members that are still out in harm's way. I like what I tell people all the time. I guarantee you, I did 2 tours in Iraq before my 21st birthday. I guarantee you right now there's a 19-year-old Marine on you know, behind a 50 cal machine gun in Afghanistan right now. That's a fact. So much love to him and much love to the people. Thank you.
Thank you, Shamar. I just wanted to thank you for not letting your conscience be quiet and following your conscience.
Yeah, and thank you again. So let's
thank
stay
you,
in touch, Shamar, because, you know, this program is here also as a forum, as a megaphone, you know, for this movement. And we want all voices to be heard and debates to take place. So stick with us here on News Dissector Radio on PRN-FM. We're going to be back in a minute.
One of the most important parts of a reform agenda is to encourage people to own something, to own their own home. Government must stand on the side of people. Because I understand if you own something, you have a vital stake.
I heard my dad saying we might lose our home.
My home.
3 million families now are said to be in danger of foreclosure. That's a 50-state Katrina. What started as manipulations and maneuvers on Wall Street has now moved to Main Street.
The cascading impact of the subprime mess is clear. No mortgage relief plan can undo the loose practices of the real estate bubble.
What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. And that holds true. Foreclosures have skyrocketed.
Not because they've lost their jobs. Not because of life circumstances. But because the mortgage is pushing them into foreclosure. Never has it happened before. People have the same income, the same job, but are losing their home.
The meltdown of the subprime mortgage market, how can I make this work for me?
They all displace themselves in our communities and rip people off.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this.
Making it that we can't afford to live in our own state, you know, where we grew up, where our children were born, and forcing us to go elsewhere.
Progressive Radio Network is now on iTunes. Search for us to listen and download past shows or get them updated automatically. Just type Progressive Radio Network in the search bar and download any show free of charge. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
PRN is your number one stop for progressive health, fitness, and food. Featuring Prescriptions for Health with Len and Vicky Saputo.
A few things on growing older now. You know you're getting old when everything either dries up or leaks.
Oh, dear.
Being young is beautiful, but being old is comfortable.
That's
for sure.
Well, if you don't have aches and pains.
That's pretty neat that you cheer us up, Vicki. We're talking about so many serious things that sometimes you can get a downer.
It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass.
We've got all this industrial agriculture going on, and I love progress and I love technology, but sometimes things get a little out of hand. And that's true when it comes to the factory farming of animals. Bad news. Horrific, cruel, environmentally damaging. People are eating a lot more today, and what's happening? Our health is in the toilet.
Fitness Express with Anthony DeMarco.
Our goal is to share the best practices of the world's best progressive fitness minds, create a forum where people can create fitness goals and get questions answered and change the way people think about fitness.
And The Natural Nurse with Ellen Cammy and Dr. Z.
One of the many topics that would be an excellent thing to focus on for yourself and your family right now is the use of herbal medicine. Make sure that you have knowledge at your fingertips to take care of yourself and your family with natural remedies, including herbs.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
To show I'm all night, can't sleep right, my head's tight. Gotta buy food, clothes, books, and it looks like there's holes in my shoes. What to do? My credit card's full, and it's due. No job, no time, no reason, no rhyme. Gotta get it together before I'm a mess. Walk the line between ruin and success. That's no joke.
I'm broke. Yes, it is. So these are part of the music that Polarity One and myself put together for our film In Debt We Trust and the film Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. If you haven't seen them, please do. I think you'll find them still very edifying about the whole struggle. There's also a new film opening up at the Quad. A friend of mine back in the days when we worked together at a summer camp, Don Goldmacher, is involved in a film called Heist. I haven't seen it yet, but it's about the financial crisis, the theft of the money of the American people, which we're going to go into in some detail. Priya Reddy is in the studio with us now. You heard her in the earlier segment. I'm here with Kat Waters. Priya has been an activist in Occupy, but in many other movements, environmental activism as well. And has considered herself an anarchist. And there's been some debate, discussion about what an anarchist is, what the anarchist position is. And maybe you can help us clarify a little of this, Priya, how you see yourself. Why do you see yourself as an anarchist?
Well, I've organized the New York City Anarchist Film Festival for the last 5 years. This will be our sixth year in honor of my comrade Brad Will, who was murdered in Oaxaca while he was filming a protest in 2006.
In Mexico, right?
In Mexico, and we showed his footage the first year. But, it's a label. And, so, like all labels, sometimes a shoe fits, whatever. But it's very much about, a true democracy. It's a Greek word, anarchy. It really means, if you want to go to the origin, without a hierarchy imposed on you. That does not mean you cannot organize or be organized or have a democratic organization or horizontal or however people think of it these days. But definitely, you don't have to wait for someone to give you orders before you act.
So you see it as a sort of the spirit of freedom, of individual choice.
Individual choice, but also accountability and individuality, not at the expense of the community, but autonomy. And a lot of these direct action, approach to direct action that we're seeing in Occupy and other movements like the radical environmental movement that you mentioned, is really about taking matters into your own hands and your community and not waiting for or begging for crumbs from the master's table, but really just manifesting and doing things, for yourself. Out of your own imagination and creativity and motivation, because they need to be done and not waiting for City Hall or whatever to grant you your wish.
Well, the Occupy movement has enunciated principles of nonviolence, for example. And there are some people in the Occupy movement who don't really subscribe to that, who don't really have a nonviolent discipline, if you will, and have engaged in violent actions that have led to violent counter actions. Those actions might have been happening anyway because the police have been violent in many cities and shutting down Occupy camps and the like.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, the rap is, you know, that the anarchists are not really disciplined. They're not really supporting the movement in terms of its principles, but their own values. And so, you know, in a way, they're disruptive of the movement, or they're putting the movement at risk. How do you feel about that?
Well, certainly, there's no monolithic anarchist group, so I wouldn't be able to represent or speak for any such group, but really just out of my own rationale and consciousness. But, you know, this violence, nonviolence debate is quite old. It's been, you know, part of all social movements, what kind of tactics. But when we're living in a time where you just yourself express these concerns about the extreme militarization and repression that the state uses to meet dissent in general and occupy, but also other movements, and people are sustaining severe injuries, you know, to me, that's where the issue of violence is really problematic, and how we survive that is an issue, and some people don't necessarily feel that being passive in the face of that kind of violence is a good survival strategy. I don't think that's necessarily endorsing that we become violent, but it's simply saying that we're not going to necessarily get our demands met if we don't even survive the violence that's coming at us, which I think is a valid concern, so...
Yeah, like that's kind of been one of my questions, like, for weeks and weeks. I mean, I'm totally in agreement with, you know, nonviolence and not being the initiator of violence. But when violence is being initiated in your direction and you're just kind of acting in, you know, self-defense, you know, self-defense can't be equated as being the initiator of violence. And, you know, the system is very good at kind of turning that around and making you the bad guy when all you're doing is, like, having a normal reaction to violence that's being thrown in your direction.
Well, I think this debate comes against, in a way, the background of, you know, what happened in the late 60s and early 70s, the emergence of weathermen, the emergence of movements that basically embraced armed struggle as their principle. They say, look, this is the war in Vietnam. So many people are dying. We have to go up against this empire and crush it somehow. And when they do that, this is also true of the Panther Party, arm yourself or harm yourself, the whole philosophy of Huey P. Newton, tends to provoke even more violence, more repression from the state. And what gets lost in all of that is it becomes about the movement, not about the issues the movement is raising. And so the issues of Wall Street oppression, the issues of the 1% dominating the 99%, the issues of joblessness and homelessness and poverty and student debt, and all of these you know, crippling problems of our democracy, Citizens United, corporate person, if you fight back against them in a violent way, the media, which is the mediating force in our society, good or bad, mostly bad, maybe,
yeah, I can agree on that.
Is going to focus on that. You know, you've heard the phrase on television, when it bleeds, it leads. Okay, and television loves violence. TV news loves violence because it's action, and they think that's what will attract more viewers to see something that's really outrageous. So let me just finish. So here's the question. You can have a personal attitude towards this, but tactically, you know, you also are part of an organization and a movement that you don't want to put at risk. When violence takes place, it's an open invitation, if you will, for more police infiltration, provocation, people, infiltrators coming in and initiating the violence. In many cases, we've seen this in the past where, you know, agents of various intelligence agencies are actually motivating and stimulating the confrontation, encouraging the violence, which then crushes the public, but also crushed in it. I mean, crushes the public that's protesting, but also crushed in it are the issues that are being raised. It becomes more the issue is the tactic, should you be violent or not, not the tactic of what's being done to us by the people in power. And that's my concern. I'm not, you know, personally, I believe that nonviolence is a powerful force. I was part of the civil rights movement. I knew Dr. King, you know, Meyer, Gandhi, all of this, you know. I'm not a religious fundamentalist on the issue, though, okay? And I know that in many cases, people fought for freedom by being forced to use a combination of tactics, certainly the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Nelson Mandela went to jail, not because just because of what he was saying, but because he was actively involved in a people's movement and a armed struggle that was bombing and blowing up, instruments of apartheid rule. So and so the freedom that the people in South Africa won so many years later was through a combination of tactics: lobbying, organizing, street fighting and street demonstrations, but also a component of armed struggle. So I'm not, you know, sort of ruling that out in all situations. So the question is, here in America right now, where the state has shown itself to be, you know, really anxious to wipe out the Occupy movement, to criminalize it, to pass new laws that they can enforce against it. It seems like, do you want to provoke, you know, the snake here? Do you want to, like, be blind to the dangers? And that's what I'm grazing. Yes.
Could I just wanted to say, like, this sort of term just came to me as I was listening to you speak. You know, on the occupation, you know, training, you know, like how they used to have, you know, on the job training.
Yeah.
So now they're getting, you know, in the occupation training, which, you know, you can only kind of like know what you're going to do, you know, right there in the moment when stuff happens, you know, and then, you know, people could do the best they can, or they can try to prepare or have the best sort of nonviolent, you know, preparation they can, but like only when the stuff is going down and there's some cop, you know, pouncing on you, that you can only like know
what
you're
going to do. I'll give you a little example. You know, the year was 1968, well before you were, you know, in this world, Priya. Okay, back in the day, as we call it,
reincarnated.
The place was London, England, and there was a massive demonstration at the American Embassy, which I was played a small role in. You know, the police in London were really all there. It was like a cavalry, like the New York City police, on horses, okay? And they just charged into these demonstrators outside the embassy. There had been no violence on the part of the demonstrators. Many were trampled by these horses. And somebody went and punched a horse, okay? Oh. Knocked the horse out, okay?
Oh, poor horse.
That
really
became the story. Every child in England was sending money to help the horse,
oh,
you know, because
not
it was
cop.
An animal in distress. And in other words, the storyline was shifted. The narrative shifted, you know, to sympathy, in this case for the horse, which meant sympathy for the police, as opposed to sympathy for people who are fighting to end an illegal and criminal, even genocidal war. And so,
absolutely,
you know, the wrong tactics can backfire in a way, and you end up then being put on the defensive. In other words, it's not like a matter of holy dictum, you know, that I'm nonviolent and therefore, you know, it's like what makes the most sense politically.
Absolutely.
To advance the interests of the movement. If the movement is splintered into many different groups, and if individuals are deciding for themselves what to do, they don't have any sense of loyalty to the movement, really. They have a sense of loyalty to their own, like, right to do their thing.
Yeah.
That's where you get into trouble, I think.
It becomes problematic when you become really attached or wedded to a particular tactic and forget that you have objectives that you share and, as a movement, and that our unity is really what's always threatened the 1%. But something you mentioned earlier, Danny, that people really need to stay focused on is the violence of Wall Street. The fact that our planet is being destroyed in front of our eyes. The fact that the immense and unimaginable, unfathomable depth of suffering that these wars have created overseas, and the poverty and the suffering and the incarceration and the misery domestically, okay, that's the violence that I think people really ought to be concerned
exactly.
with. And please, let's remember that this is a largely peaceful movement that's not harmed any human beings. If property doesn't feel pain like human beings do, if a window gets smashed, no, I don't have the same sympathy.
Well, let's talk about this in a minute,
for
because
that
I want to segue.
Someone gets socked by a cop.
We're running a little out of time, so I want to try to get to this. One of the documentaries that was nominated for an Oscar, but which didn't win. It's a documentary about the Earth Liberation Front in California. And you know some of the people involved in that. We'd like to play the trailer for you about this film, because this is a film, you know, and a movement that many anarchists have adopted and supported.
On the night of the arson, they put on their masks and then placed the 5-gallon fuel containers and activated the timing devices.
911, where is your emergency?
The Earth Liberation Front is turning up the heat again, igniting devastating blazes all across the country.
Fire bombings included attacks on lumber mills, wild horse corrals, and meatpacking plants.
This investigation was the largest domestic terrorism case in the history of the United States.
Sometimes when you see things you love being destroyed, you just want to destroy those things.
I was like, man, this is butchered. It made me think, like, why are we being so gentle?
The goal is to just send a message that consumer America is destroying the world.
When the big bad bully gets hit in the stomach and feels a little fear, that felt good.
After the fire, you really looked over your shoulder.
People go home at night wondering if they're going to be a target. That's what terrorism is.
Eco-terrorism.
Eco-terrorist.
Eco-terrorism.
Environmental terrorism.
The police were amping up their presence, and people's views got hardened.
This is what we want you to do. We want you to wear a wire.
You don't have to be Bonnie and Clyde to be a bank robber, and you don't have to be Al Qaeda to be.
Well, that's the trailer for If a Tree Falls, which is one of the documentaries that have been nominated for an Oscar, did not win. Undefeated one, which was Sean, you know, Peter, what, who is it? Beyonce's. Not Beyonce, Sean Combs was the producer, executive producer. Harvey Weinstein, a big Hollywood mogul, was supporting Undefeated, which is the documentary about high school football that did win, but this one didn't. But nevertheless, the issues raised in the film are important ones. Many people are still in prison as part of this movement. Just give us a quick update on what's happening there.
The movie If a Tree Falls, which was nominated for an Academy Award, brings up a lot of issues from the environmental crisis and why people are, you know, choosing the tactics that they are, the extreme nature of the environmental crisis, but also this increasing disturbing pattern of viewing dissent in America as terrorism. But I don't think anybody wakes up one day and says, hey, I think I'm going to burn this down or pick up a gun. I think there's a progression of trying many, many things and just meeting with failure and helplessness and needing to choose, wanting to desperately make a difference and stop the evil things in our world, and, you know, ending up choosing these tactics. But, you know, America has a long history of economic sabotage from the Boston Tea Party on. It's not really a new thing, but that it's happening now in the defense of the environment, because our planet is being destroyed. We won't even be able to breathe the air without getting cancer. People are feeling very much, we've inherited this mess and we have to do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the young men who was sent to prison for over 10 years was accused of setting a car dealership, I guess, on fire.
No, just an SUV. And also, please, we're both media activists. We've got to say something about the use of language. Nobody, when they use the word firebomb, it's just very inaccurate. Arson, just, you know, call it what it is. There's no bombs. There's no explosive force used. The media constantly harps on this term called eco-terrorism. The movie talks about that a little bit. But we need to define as citizens where the terrorists coming from, what's actually being destroyed, and who's being terrified here. I mean, so I don't think some vegan tree sitter up in a tree somewhere is a terrorist. I think the corporations that are destroying everything beautiful, it could be considered terrorism.
Well, there you go. And that's Priya Reddy. Last word, Catherine, be quick. Watch the clock. I always tell you every week, don't start a new subject when we have 1 minute to go.
I just wanted to agree with what she said. People love to focus on, you know, the unskilled actions of the Occupy people when, like, how else can they react under such desperate situations, you know, instead of focusing on what Wall Street does, on what the 1% destruction does.
Well, there we go. And these are issues that we could...
Can I just say one last?
Yes, please.
Just in a day and age when we're looking at the Republican candidates, none of whom are pro-choice, in this day and age, the horror of that, to see these vapid, empty airbags, and then to see, you know, Obama, who's, you know, maybe at best he's meant well, but, like, you know, you can judge for yourself where Obama is in standing up to this Congress. Occupy really is that third, not lesser of two evils, but something that isn't evil. We're not talking about it as a political party, but people have put their faith and trust in elected officials, and that's led to what? Tragic outcomes. So now it's like Occupy is that third choice, not just who you're going to vote for.
Okay. With that passionate point, we're going to have to wrap up right now. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. My new book is called Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street. Copies are available at the McNally Jackson bookstore, the pre-publication copies. It's coming out from Cosimo Press very soon. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. I write the newsdissector.net blog, and I'll be posting the URL for this broadcast, the podcast of this broadcast, which has been rocketing along, very passionate, and I'm sure you'll want to share it with others, so please do. Progressive Radio Network makes this possible, PRN.FM. Please become a listener and tell others about the program. Thank you, Matt, Jason, all the team here for making this show possible every week. We'll be back next week, same time, same station.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa, Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must.